This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Joseph O'Neill, the author of the best-selling novel Netherland, which was recently published in paperback. It's the novel President Obama said he was reading in the evenings. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan described Netherland as a novel about post-9/11 New York City, as viewed through the scrim of F. Scott Fitzgerald's masterpiece, The Great Gatsby. New York Times book critic Dwight Garner said that on a macro level, Netherland is about nearly everything: family, politics, identity. The narrator, Hans, is a Dutch-born investment banker who moves to New York from London with his wife Rachel and their young son in the late 1990s. After 9/11, Rachel takes their son and moves back to London, where she thinks they'll be safer. On his own and lonely in New York, Hans discovers a subculture of immigrants who play cricket, and he gets involved with one of them, who's part dreamer, part con man. Joseph O'Neill was born in Ireland and grew up in Africa, Iran, Turkey, and Holland. Netherland won the 2009 Penn Faulkner Award. Joseph O'Neill, welcome to Fresh Air. So has President Obama finished your book yet? Do you have any idea?
I haven't heard yet. And I'm not sure that I ever will hear.
What was your reaction when you found out he was reading it?
Well, I mean, I'm a big, you know, Obama fan, and I was a supporter during the election, so and the primary. So I was thrilled privately, but on the other hand, I suppose if I sort of reflect about it, I sort of feel in a way that it would be wrong to be too thrilled, because why shouldn't a president read a novel? You know, in this case, it happens to be mine, and I sort of feel that it's. There's such a sort of asymmetrical relationship between the president and the rest of the world in terms of power that it can only be good for the soul of such a powerful man, whether it's this president or another, to submit temporarily to the authority of a novel. Because, you know, whatever the nature of the novel, it is actually ultimately a submissive act to read a novel. You do think... For the period of time during which you're reading the novel, you're acknowledging the supremacy of this text, even if, of course, you own your own interpretation of it. And I think that that there's something healthy about the scale of that activity for somebody in his position of power.
Well, I'd really like our listeners to hear a sense of your writing. So I'm going to ask you to do a reading from page 23. And this is right after September 11th. You remember, the couple has just moved to New York a few years ago. And his wife decides that she's going to take their four-year-old son and move back to London because it's just so unsafe in New York. And the husband, your main character, offers to come too. And this is where the reading picks up.
The ashtray rustled as she stubbed out her cigarette. "Let's not make too many big decisions," my wife said. "We might come to regret it. We'll think more clearly in a month or two." Much of the subsequent days and nights was spent in an agony of emotions and options and discussions. It is truly a terrible thing when questions of love and family and home are no longer answerable. We talked about Rachel giving up her job or going part-time, about moving to Brooklyn or Westchester or, what the hell, New Jersey. But that didn't meet the problem of Indian Point. There was, apparently, a nuclear reactor at a place called Indian Point, just 30 miles away in Westchester County. If something bad happened there, we were constantly being informed. The radioactive debris, whatever this might be, was liable to rain down on us. Indian Point, the earliest, most incurable apprehension stirred in its very name. Then there was the question of dirty bombs. Apparently, any fool could build a dirty bomb and explode it in Manhattan. How likely was this? Nobody knew. Very little about anything seemed intelligible or certain, and New York itself, that ideal source of the metropolitan diversion that serves as a response to the largest futilities, took on a fearsome, monstrous nature whose reality might have befuddled Plato himself. We were trying, as I irrelevantly analyzed it, to avoid what might be termed a historic mistake. We were trying to understand, that is, whether we were in a pre-apocalyptic situation, like the European Jews in the 30s or the last citizens of Pompeii, or whether our situation was merely near-apocalyptic, like that of the Cold War inhabitants of New York, London, Washington, and for that matter, Moscow.
You know, that question you ask at the end, I always, always wonder about that. How do people know, for instance, how do the Jews know in Nazi Germany that it's time to get out, like right before it's too late? How do they know? Mm-hmm. How do the people in any war situation know when it's time to flee? Did that question go through your mind after September 11th? You, like your character, had moved to New York in 1998.
Yes, I think, I mean, I lived in New York City, and still do, in Manhattan, at the time of the attacks, and I think everybody at that time was utterly disoriented and very much concerned about whether or not it would be safe to stay in New York City. I mean, we really had no idea where this had come from, and it was pretty clear that the authorities had very little idea of what was going on as well. And I think that in addition to trying to understand the questions of personal safety, you're also, and this is a very challenging issue, you're also in the position of coming to terms with the fragility and vulnerability of the individual conscience in the face of history.
After 9/11, when his wife decides she's going to take her son and move back to London and be in a safer place, and your main character, the husband, stays alone in New York, living at the Chelsea Hotel because their apartment in Tribeca is no longer inhabitable because of 9/11. You have a great description of him being just like depressed and immobilized by depression. You write, "On my own, it was as if I were hospitalized at the Chelsea Hotel." It was such a great image of your room as like a hospital. Can you talk a little bit about coming up with that?
I think that I remember one guy I met at the Chelsea, which is where I live with my family, once observed to me that this place is a hospital for creatives. That's a quote. And I like the idea. And of course, hospitalization has a very pronounced medical connotation, but it also has a non-medical connotation of refuge. And that is one of the features of the Chelsea Hotel, which is that it has served as a refuge for certain vulnerable spirits over the years.
Can you tell us what the initial idea was for your novel, like where it started in your mind?
Well, I came to New York in 1998, like the narrator of this novel. And I began, and I wanted to play cricket. It was May 1998, and cricket is a sport I've played every summer of my life since the age of 10. And so I asked people, you know, where can I play cricket? And, of course, nobody knew, and it took a while to track down these cricket clubs, the cricket scene of New York, which is invisible and almost impenetrable because the clubs are not very accessible. And then it dawned on me that this was a potentially dramatically and symbolically interesting situation, this cricket world, this unknown cricket world. And so I sort of formed the idea at that point that there was a novel here and started working on it. And then 9/11 happened, and then the sort of history and current events became superimposed on this slightly more literary starting point.
The cricket community that your character finds, which I assume is the same community that you found, is a community of immigrants playing cricket from South Asia. You're one of the main characters is from Trinidad. Mm-hmm. And I always thought of cricket, I don't know much about cricket, but I always thought of it as this very British, very white sport. And it is so not a white sport. And in the immigrant community that you describe that plays cricket in New York. So through playing cricket, what are some of the people, what's some of the world that you were introduced to that you otherwise would not have had access to?
Well, I mean, it certainly is. It certainly, without my own personal participation in this pastime, I would not have had access to, you know, the world of the West Indian and South Asian immigrants in New York City. I don't want to kind of over-romanticize the whole idea of intercultural contact. This is, you know, we're playing a sport together, and if cricket had been played by a bunch of reactionary white guys, I imagine I would have continued playing anyway. But for novelistic purposes, what's interesting about cricket is its very incomprehensibility in American culture and its very invisibility. So that there's a character who says there's a limit to what Americans understand, and that limit is cricket. But it did seem to me that to insert cricket in an American novel is effectively to confront the American reader with the other, with the alien, and to challenge the reader in I hope an agreeable and an enjoyable way, with an expansion of his or her horizons, and with the consideration of what it might mean to expand those horizons.
What got you thinking about the whole rags to riches, self-invention American story, and how easy or difficult it is to actually achieve that as an immigrant in America, and what immigrants in America really are up against?
Well, I actually think that immigrants have a much better chance of rags to riches than people who are born here, who are born in the rags side of that equation. I mean, there's surprisingly little social mobility in the United States for people who are born here. And whereas the immigrants who arrive are self-selecting, go-getting, motivated types on the whole, and almost by definition, in fact.
Because they managed to get out of the country, they found a way to get here, they've managed to figure out a way to survive here, is that what you mean?
Well, I mean, it's such an enormous step to leave your country and start again all over again in another country that it's very rarely that you get people arriving from another part of the world saying it's my ambition to go to the United States and do nothing. You would only get that fraction of the population which takes seriously the question of material progress and the question of doing something with your life and the question of improving one's lot that actually arrives here. So it's my basic starting point in relation to immigration is that every time a new face shows up, that's great news. It means the country has received a fresh shot of energy.
There's an image that I like to talk about in your book that I think will really resonate with people who have lost one or both of their parents, but who have lost parents who lived far away and who they didn't get to see often. And this is what your main character thinks after his mother dies. And the main character lives in New York. His mother had lived in Holland. And he says, "I did not summon her up by the way of remembrance, but rather by fantasy. The fantasy did not consist of imagining her physically at my side, but of imagining her at a long distance, as before, and me still remotely swaddled in her consideration." I just think that's so interesting, that what he's holding on to isn't images of them together, but of knowing that she's thinking of him and that she's there, even if it's at a distance.
Mm. Well, Hans, I mean, one of the great dramas in Hans's life, and one of the sources of the rather melancholic view of the world which suffuses this book, is that his mother has died, and he is doing his best to mourn her without, I think he feels, any real acknowledgement from his wife or indeed from anybody as to what this involves. But the mourning is complicated by the thought which he states in the novel. He says, "But soon a more disquieting idea took possession of my thoughts, namely that my mother had long ago become an imaginary being of sorts, which is to say that the separation which characterized their relationship for a long period of time consigned her to the place of memory rather than to actuality, and he suspects the same was true in her case, so that she remembered him as a little boy rather than this large, lumbering grown-up."
My guest is Joseph O'Neill, author of the novel Netherland. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph O'Neill. He's the author of the best-selling novel Netherland. Before you became a novelist, you were a barrister in England. And I think a lot of us Americans don't really understand, is a barrister a lawyer? Is a barrister something different than a lawyer? Would you explain?
Well, the English and indeed Irish legal professions is divided into two. There's solicitors, who do 90% of the work, and most of it non-contentious, so that if you want a will done, etc., you go see a solicitor. And then if things look like they're heading towards court, then you bring in the barrister, and the barrister is the one with the wig and the gown. And so I was one of those characters who has a wig and a gown and goes to court and argues cases in court. That's a barrister.
This is going to sound like such a stupid question. Does it feel silly to put on that wig? It's just...
Actually, no, there's nothing. I mean, these wigs are made of horsehair, and they're never washed, and they're kept in a tin, so that when you open your tin, your wig tin, as it's called, which has your name on it, you know, this rather distinctive smell is released. And it's the smell of, you know, of the courtroom. And so the juices, you have this kind of slightly sort of rather sickening and distasteful kind of Proustian or Pavlovian relationship with this smell. So that as soon as you open your wig tin, your adrenaline starts running and you're ready, and you kind of get ready for court. I mean, it is a bit scratchy and it can get a bit itchy. And it's quite funny when you see older barristers who've been doing it for many years, you know, because it looks like because these wigs gradually start to disintegrate and you never replace them. So it looks like a sort of dead rat is on their heads after a while.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're making it sound really horrible. So why?
It is.
Why is this an institution that is still being kept? You know, that the institution of the wig.
Well, I think there are very practical reasons for preserving the custom of wearing a wig, which is only worn incidentally in some courtrooms and in some situations, not in all of them. I mean, the main one being that it neutralizes and equalizes the physical appearance of the advocates, and it also adds to the gravity of the occasion. I mean, and it seems to me that, you know, it's so we live in a world of, in particular now, where it's so difficult to locate any situation of gravity or any situation when authority is able to hold sway. That I don't think it does any harm to have a little prop, which makes the whole thing seem quite solemn. And in fact, I think that if they've done, you know, they've asked the lawyers and they've asked the people who use their clients, the people who are the consumers of justice, whether they want to preserve the wig and the gown, then they all say yes. I think they like a bit of they like the costume drama of it.
So, in spite of the fact that it smelled and it itched, you like the sense of authority and occasion that it brought to your work?
Well, I mean, I took all that for granted. I just, I mean, I think, you know, it's like the smell of gunpowder. You know, you put on the wig and, you know, that you get ready to do battle. And you know, it's not just a wig, by the way. You have to put on a little, you have to put on a stiff collar and a little bands, they're called, these two little white rectangles, which sort of serve as a kind of necktie, and then you wear your gown on top of your suit, and off you go.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph O'Neill. He's the author of the best-selling novel Netherland. There's a scene at the Department of Motor Vehicles in which you describe how, like, really kind of sullen all the people who work there are. And I grew up in New York, and I remember the DMV, which was then the Motor Vehicles Bureau in Brooklyn, was just such an unpleasant place. And your character fails his driver's test first time around. And I failed my permit test the first time around, and I had just, like, graduated high school. And, yeah. And you know, I'd done well on tests in school, and I failed my permit test, and I felt so incredibly stupid.
You know? Are you talking about your written test?
The written test. I failed it.
Oh, my God.
Exactly.
That is shameful.
Exactly.
Is this the first time you've confessed this?
On the air, certainly. So how did you feel when you failed your driving test?
Well, Hans failed
his driving test. I don't know if you
feel,
actually, I guess Hans failed his driving test.
I regret to say that this is a slightly autobiographical part of the story. You know, one of the sort of black comedies of New York immigrant life is that, you know, you arrive in New York City, you've been driving for many, many years without incident, and then when you come here, you're essentially forced to do your test all over again. And me, I, and many other people In my situation, you know, we go down to this place in Red Hook and we're all promptly failed as if we can't drive. And, you know, and infuriatingly, you see these 16-year-olds kind of shaking 16-year-olds sort of triumphantly waving their documents around. And what I and my friends ended up doing, you know, after I sort of cracked it, is this, you basically sort of leave, you don't do it in Brooklyn, in Red Hook, you have to go to somewhere more reasonable in the suburbs or the exurbs of New York, and they're much more likely to give you, recognize the fact that you can drive up there.
Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, there were probably, I wonder whether the whole New York driving test system is run on a kind of, whether they get paid every time they, you know, in other words, if you fail somebody three times, you get paid three times. Whether it's just a job creation scheme, but I, like Hans, said, you know, I just drove around the block once and I was told that I'd failed a million times. It was just terrifying. I mean, it was actually slightly devastating.
Well, I enjoyed that part in the book. I'm glad you put it in. Joseph O'Neill, thanks so much for talking with us.
My great pleasure.
Joseph O'Neill is the author of the novel Netherland. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Protests resumed today in Iran on the 10th anniversary of a student uprising against the Islamic regime. My guest, Roya Hakakian, grew up in Iran under the Shah and the Ayatollah Khomeini. She was 12 during the revolution and joined in the protests against the Shah. But Hakakian is Jewish. Her father was the headmaster of a Hebrew school in Tehran. And under the revolutionary Islamic government, Jews were subjected to increasing restrictions. She left Iran in 1984 and in 1985 was granted political asylum in the U.S. Hakakian is a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center and is a fellow at Yale University's Whitney Humanities Center. Last week, we talked about the protests in Iran against the re-election of President Ahmadinejad. We invited her back to talk about her memoir, Journey from the Land of No, A Girlhood Caught in Revolutionary Iran. Roya Hakakian, welcome back to Fresh Air. You describe Jews in Iran as a breed on the verge of extinction, but at the time of the revolution, there were 100,000 Jews in Iran, and it was the second largest community of Jews in the Middle East after Israel. What did it mean to be Jewish under the Shah? Did you have a sense of being marginalized or discriminated against, ghettoized?
It's a wonderful question because it was a bifurcated experience. And I mean bifurcated by the virtue that my own experience varied greatly from what my parents recalled and remembered as their own experience. My father grew up in a very small village, which is now a major town or perhaps even a city, called Khonsar in Iran, you know, 80 years ago. And he had a very rough childhood. And, you know, I talk about that a bit in the book, that even on rainy days, he was not allowed to go to school because Jews were not allowed to walk on the streets on rainy days.
Because
Jews are considered unclean, and as a result of being unclean, when the rain splashes off of a Jewish person, there is the likelihood that, you know, the dirty rain splashing off of that Jewish person could land on a Muslim passing by and therefore dirty the Muslim passerby. Bigotry is hard to explain. But my father's memories were far more different than my experiences. When I was growing up in Tehran, I never felt anything remotely similar to what my father had experienced. And it was growing up in the shadow of his recollections, especially, that was always an intellectual preoccupation for me, because here I was, a Jewish person growing up in Tehran, not at all under the same pressures, but yet living in its shadows and having to reconcile as a result who I was, what I wanted to be, and who I was in relationship to my parents, and whether loyalty really meant that I had to uphold those memories, and if so, to what degree.
Were you growing up in a Jewish neighborhood?
I wasn't. I mean, there were Jews who lived in my area and specifically on my block. But, you know, the beauty of Tehran in the 1960s and the 1970s was that there were no Jewish neighborhoods. In other words, there were no ghettos. Jews of Iran were so assimilated in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s that you really couldn't identify one neighborhood as strictly Jewish. And it was really hard even to tell Jewish people apart from the rest of the, you know, ordinary Iranians out on the streets.
One of your older brothers, when he was a college freshman, participated in a demonstration against the Shah on the campus. And he was detained overnight by SAVAK, which is the Shah's intelligence agency. What impact did that have on the family?
Well, a terrible one, because as a result of that, my father immediately realized that my brothers could not stay in Iran. They were young university students. One of them was 17 at the time, and the other one was 19, and that they should be sent to America to be kept safe. And they both came here to the States in 1978, and my oldest brother had already been here from the mid-70s. And that really created a major rupture in my family, from which we, in some ways, never recovered.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, they left in 78. My two youngest brothers left in 78. And by the time my mother and I arrived, it was 1985. And so much had happened in those years, both to them and to us. And it's one thing when families are separated for a job. You know, one person goes to this state, another one goes to another state. It's another thing when in that interim of separation, there is a revolution and a war and displacement and so much more. And it was really hard to sit down and try to catch up with my brothers. I think we never did. There was no way that we could fill each other in on the years that we had been apart.
What were the first signs that you saw in Iran that a revolution was starting?
Oh, street noise. Slogans that would surface on the walls of our streets in the mornings. You know, the walls will be clean, and then you would wake up the next day and there would be a slogan written across the wall. It was a very tense time that even in the most quiet moments of the day, you could feel the palpable tension kind of buzzing in the air. And at nights, of course, there were lots and lots of shouts and demonstrations and even shootings. You know, people were out on the streets and guards were after them shooting.
In 1978, there was a national oil company strike which paralyzed the economy of Iran. And that's often looked back now as an example of how powerful a strike in Iran can be. Do you have memories of that 1978 strike?
The queues. You know, the queues were, you know, the most prominent feature of our lives. And I will never forget how odd it was. I mean, it practically transformed the look of the block, because from the distribution center, which was at the corner of our block, they had tied a rope to the door handle of the distribution center. And because the queue was so long and people were so desperate for oil, and we wanted to make sure that nobody was cutting in the line, we would pass our buckets through the rope. So even if you left the queue, your bucket would still be in line. And these ropes and these dangling buckets from these ropes were there for weeks. And they had changed the landscape by virtue of them being there, but also simply by the fact that people would aggregate and congregate around these ropes and around their buckets and talk. And it was one of the manifestations of how Iran had come to a standstill in 1978.
Would you describe one of the revolutionary demonstrations that you participated in and what it felt like to be there?
I can't remember one in 1978 or 1979 at least not until the fall of the Shah, that I personally participated in. I was usually on the sidewalks watching. But the one collective event that I did participate in and really was moved by was going up to the rooftop at 9 o'clock in December of 1978 and shouting Allahu Akbar, or God is great. It was a magnificent experience to know that all of us were in it together, to know that everybody in the neighborhood in pitch dark was standing on the rooftop shouting the same thing. It made me realize that social movements, that a collective experience can be such a formative and such a magnificent experience for a young person to have. And I love being there.
My guest is Roya Hakakian, author of the memoir Journey from the Land of No, about growing up Jewish in revolutionary Iran. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Roya Hakakian. She wrote a memoir about growing up Jewish in Iran under the Shah and then during the revolution, and it's called Journey from the Land of No. She's also a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. The Jewish community of Tehran sent a delegation to visit the Ayatollah and basically ask, how will the Jewish people be treated in Iran in the new Islamic State? And one of the people on the 6-member delegation was a close boyhood friend of your father's. What was the message that the delegation got from the Ayatollah Khomeini?
The Ayatollah had actually given them his entire attention, full attention, meaning that there were no other people within his quarters when they visited him in Qom, the holy city, in March or April of 1979. And they were very grateful for that. And the Ayatollah gave a very long and convoluted speech, which had befuddled them in the beginning. But at the end, he made a very important statement, which was sort of the punchline of the speech. And it was, we separate the account of our Jewish community from the blood-sucking Zionists in Israel. And the delegation brought that statement back, and it was immediately painted on the walls of synagogues and Jewish schools and other Jewish establishments throughout Tehran and, you know, wherever, you know, the few other cities where the Jewish community existed in Iran.
It was a strange statement. I mean, he was basically saying, if I understand correctly, our Iranian Jews are good, unlike those Jewish Zionists in Israel who are godless and horrible. So our Jews are okay, but there's lots of other Jews that aren't okay. And you say the phrase that the Ayatollah said about separating the Iranian Jews from the godless Zionists or the blood-sucking Zionists of Israel, that phrase was painted on the walls of every synagogue by nightfall. What was the point of painting it? To spread the message that this is what the Ayatollah thinks? And was that meant to reassure people or to scare people or what?
It was their way of delivering the Ayatollah's message to the followers of the Ayatollah throughout Iran.
So it was a way of saying, leave us alone, like we're the good Jews. The Ayatollah says,
cool.
We're the good Jews, leave us alone.
Yes. We have the stamp of the Ayatollah's approval. Look, you know, it's true you want to fight Israel and the Palestinian issue is a major issue, but we're the good Jews that the Ayatollah okayed.
How long did you stay the good Jews in the Ayatollah's esteem?
The Iranian Jews have consistently been categorized as the good Jews since then. I mean, that statement was fundamentally important for the Iranian Jewish community because it was really a way to say, look, whatever it is that you feel about Israel or the Zionists or the wrongs that have been done to the Palestinians, we have had nothing to do with it. That's all politics beyond our borders. We have always been here. We have existed in Iran long before there was a government of Israel, long before even there was Islam in Iran, and we want to keep it that way. It was a way of delineating very strict boundaries between the Jewish community in Iran and the political issues surrounding Israel.
But eventually, non-Muslim store owners and restaurant owners had to put signs on their doors saying this store or this restaurant is owned by a non-Muslim, which was certainly a form of discrimination. And you say that a new hardliner type principal took over your school, and she even wanted to convert the Jews to Islam.
God knows she tried very hard, and God also knows that she failed.
How did your parents, who were very observant Jews, feel about this?
They actually were very scared, but in a way prepared, because they always had their own previous experiences to refer to.
Because there was so much anti-Semitism when they were growing up.
Yes. And so they had that background. And to them, it was like, oh, so it's back to that again. And so they were ready for it in ways that we weren't. My generation wasn't. But, you know, on the other hand, several other of my classmates found it extremely comical because, you know, there was this fundamentalist woman. And I do believe that fundamentalism behaves in the same way across all religions. And, you know, she sounded awkward and she was a cartoonish character. And we basically sat in the back of the school lunchroom and really giggled the whole time. I mean, even as she spoke, we would mimic her and laugh during her entire talk.
Your parents decided it was time to leave during, I think it was during the Iran-Iraq War. And is it right to assume that part of it was the growing amount of anti-Semitism and also just the dangers of living in Iran during the war?
Well, let me make one clarification, because as an Iranian, I think I need to make this point that the anti-Semitic behavior or measures that were implemented in Iran during those years were implemented by the government and the people. Our ordinary neighbors and friends were not, in fact, falling in line with what the regime was dictating. It's very important for me to say that I believe that the Iranian regime has been, ever since 1979, much more regressive than the general Iranian population. And it was the regime that wanted to implement anti-Semitic measures, and in many ways, the Iranian people wouldn't go along with it. The regime had made it very difficult for those Iranians who were not ideological, who were not sympathetic to the regime, to make a good living. So if you were not a student who could, say, bring in a letter of recommendation from the local mullah at the mosque, you would have less chances of getting into the university, or at least get into a good university. And, you know, so it became very difficult for ordinary Iranians who weren't on the side of the regime to hope for a great future. And of course, 1984 was the fourth year of war with Iraq. Everything was rationed, and there were shortages of the basic staples of life, and there was no end in sight. So leaving was a very logical thing to do.
You're in touch with a lot of people in Iran now through the human rights work that you do. Do you still have family or friends in Iran?
I have a lot of friends, but they're not friends that I had when I was growing up. You know, the beauty of being a writer and being away from Iran, if there is any beauty about it, is that some of my work, without even my own knowledge, made their way back to Iran, and people eventually brought me anthologies of women's poetry that have been published in Iran in recent years that include some of my poems. And so as a result of these things and these exchanges, I find that even though I can't go back to Iran, my work goes back to Iran, and there's a wonderful sense of returning without physically returning and connecting to a whole new range of people I didn't know before, but you know, but people who read and connect with me on other levels and with whom I now correspond.
For a lot of Jewish people around the world, the Iranian President Ahmadinejad's denial of the Holocaust and his real hatred of Israel and statements like it should be wiped off the map, these are very frightening things to Jewish people around the world, and I wonder how you interpret it. You know, knowing Iran the way you do, having lived there, what do you hear when you hear him make those statements?
I hear the man that that people in Iran want to get rid of, say yet another strange and unbelievable and stupid remark. You know, it doesn't startle me or astound me as much as it does others, because I know that there is another Iran. I know that there is an Iran that objects to the man who denies the Holocaust. And I have always found that what the rest of the world needs to discover is the fact that even as he uttered these things, even as Ahmadinejad denied the Holocaust, there were journalists and other intellectuals writing and working inside Iran who objected to him and who were imprisoned as a result. So for me, the struggle is always to show the rest of the world that there is in Iran a strong criticism against the very man that everybody else objects to.
Well, Roya Hakakian, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
I was delighted to be with you. Thanks.
Roya Hakakian is a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center and a fellow at Yale University's Whitney Humanities Center. Her memoir is called Journey from the Land of No. Hombre Lobo is the first studio album in 5 years by the band known as Eels. The man behind the band is Mark Oliver Everett, better known to his fans as E. Along with two other musicians, E turns Hombre Lobo into what he calls 12 songs of desire. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
With his long beard, fuzzy blues rock guitars, and trio band, Mark Oliver Everett and Eels could remind you a little of ZZ Top. But pretty soon after diving into Hombre Lobo, you realize that this music is less Tres Hombres and Wolfish than it is sotto voce and melancholy.
My love is always just as she seems, a force of nature all her own to be reckoned with. Whatever's wrong with me, her kiss redeems.
Mark Oliver Everett, known as E, makes good on the subtitle of his album, which is 12 Songs of Desire. Again and again, whether he sings in a growl meant to be heard over loud guitars, or a high tenor croon with more gently strummed instruments, E is a sensitive soul, unafraid to sound yearning or needy, or in this case, whining and jealous.
I never thought that I could be so bold to even say these thoughts aloud. See you with your man, your eyes just shine, while he stands tall and walking proud. That look you give that guy, I wanna see, looking right at me.
Between the release of this album and his last one, E made a documentary about his life with his father, the quantum physicist Hugh Everett III. It was called Parallel World, Parallel Lives, and it was a portrait of how to come to terms with a brilliant, rather distant father, and that old pattern of opting to do something in life that's as far from what your parent does, to either rebel or simply to establish one's own identity. The documentary was, like much of E's music, meticulous, intelligent, and self-consciously chilly. It ended up proving that father and son were more alike than not. Although I doubt the quantum physicist would accidentally hop on the Twilight True Blood bandwagon with a song about needing fresh blood.
Fresh blood.
I like Hombre Lobo most when E is expressing his desire in its most forceful form. For me, the high point is the song Prize Fighter, which uses the metaphor of a man who'll battle for the affection of the woman he wants. It's the Hombre at his Loboiest. I'm a go-all-nighter. I'm a prize fighter. I love that line. In general, Hombre Lobo is an uneven piece of work because it sounds like a transitional album for this musician. He's moving into the middle period of his career and middle age. He can still tap into the sort of romantic insecurity and anguish that rock and roll used to encourage as a music of adolescence. But we're long past that period of popular music, with senior citizens now making rock music as vehement as anything a teenager can muster. For E, for Mark Oliver Everett, this means ongoing worlds of discovery, worlds that he doesn't even need a full moon or a transformation into a wolfman to explore.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Hombre Lobo by the band Eels.